This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM and webcasting at kcrw.com.
From KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Bye-bye Michael Brown, and the latest in the Katrina story, plus John Roberts' promotion and Arnold's imminent gay marriage veto. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum from San Francisco is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the Los Angeles Times. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, editorial page editor and columnist at the Washington Times and author of The West's Last Chance, his new book due out this coming week. And here with me in Santa Monica and in the fourth dimension of political time and space is our own Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of the HuffingtonPost.com. Well, as we went to air on Friday, the big news, overdue in the view of many critics, unjustified, I suppose, in the view of some, there must be someone who thinks it's unjustified, but FEMA Director Michael Brown has been removed from his role managing Hurricane Katrina relief efforts. He was not removed from his position, but taken out of the central lead operating role on the ground, being sent back to Washington from Baton Rouge. And he's being replaced by Coast Guard Vice Admiral Thad Allen, who was overseeing New Orleans relief and rescue efforts. Arianna, you've been watching this. Take it where you will. This is obviously just another touch point in what has been a brewing political firestorm, obviously, but also a real human tragedy.
Well, it shows once again how much better this administration is at managing political crisis than at managing national crisis. I mean, immediately they moved into damage control mode. You had the incredible phenomenon of them saying that anybody who tries to assess blame for what happened, which of course is incredibly important since you have to continue dealing with the tragedy of Katrina, it's not over, is immediately accused of politicizing the tragedy. And you now see this talking point of blame game, as the administration calls it, entering in the language of anchors and interviewers everywhere. We had also this amazing phenomenon on Sunday and Monday where Newsweek and the Washington Post used anonymous senior government officials to put out absolute inaccuracies, one of which had to be corrected by the Washington Post a few hours later, arguing or claiming that the governor of Louisiana had not called a state of emergency on August 26, as in fact she had done, something which basic fact-checking would have found. And this, I went and looked at the Washington Post ethical guidelines, and it absolutely directly contradicts it. So you have, again, that same problem we had with Blamegate, the same problem we've seen throughout the administration's life of the major media regurgitating anonymous government officials and using their spin as though it were fact. That's one of the things that has emerged out of this tragedy.
Although I think, and Tony, let me get you into this, both on what it means that Michael Brown has been deposed from this role, and also I don't think, much as the media can be accused of being sort of stenographers to Bush often, that in general people would view the media's response to this crisis as being purely stenographic. It seems to be one of the rare examples where the media's almost really gotten it on its high horse, being so upset. And there's been so many instances of Brian Williams or Anderson Cooper and others that you've seen really taking on officials in a strong way. Tony, what's happened?
Well, first of all, the president has taken a hard press, and a deservedly hard one, and including a hard press from my pages of the Washington Times. So there's plenty of responsibility to be doled out, and the president's going to get his fair share. Regarding Brown, there's an important point to make, because the problem there, and it starts with his appointment because he was unqualified, and it follows with the other people who were appointed at a senior level, basically out of advanced man slots in the Bush campaign. The result, and I've been talking with someone who has impeccable, very high-level knowledge of that agency in the last 24 hours, that the result of those appointments and the lowering of morale in that agency has resulted in the early retirement of any number of senior civil servants who are extremely qualified, and that these are the reasons why FEMA has not performed up to the standard that we would expect of it. This is important for beyond chastising people. This is important because it argues, I believe, against what is currently the early rise to say, let's cut it, take it out of Homeland Security. That's a debate one can have, but the problem isn't that it was placed in Homeland Security, and indeed some people I know whose judgment I respect think it does fit well in there. The problem is that it was mismanaged, and the lack of leadership from above demoralized the staff and resulted in quittings and, as a result, poor performance this time.
Well, I want to get Bob in, but maybe the lesson then, Tony, is we all know political patronage is going to have its place, and that people who were, you know, allies of incoming presidents, some of them end up getting jobs, and that goes back to, what, Andrew Jackson and, you know, all of human history, but for goodness sake, maybe those people belong at the Commerce Department or the Small Business Administration, not in senior levels where you have to manage real disasters that require expertise and competence, Bob.
Yeah, there are plenty of backwater spots in the government that can take the political appointees. And at the lower and middle levels, what's called the Schedule Cs, get in some government experience. There's nothing wrong with that. That both parties have been doing it forever. But at the top levels of vital agencies, it's nuts.
Bob, jump in.
Oh, thank you. Let me just say, I there isn't much to disagree with here. I like what Tony is saying and Ariana. The only caveat I have is that Tony is correct in his devastating critique of FEMA, but he's forgetting who appointed these people. It was the president. And the president. Let me just emphasize it more then. I'm sorry. But the Washington Post today has a devastating story about what happened with FEMA, that this is not just a couple of guys put in there, but they basically destroyed this agency at a time when they told us they were very concerned about our well-being and security. And so I think that really has to be explored. As far as I just was listening to the press conference that Chertoff had, and it was outrageous. They're talking about spending hundreds of billions of our tax revenues. They're talking about, you know, lives that have been lost unnecessarily. And this guy has the arrogance to get up there and say, I'm only going to take three questions. And when one of those questions asks about Brown's fake resume, he says that's not in the ground rules. Well, when did the First Amendment give us ground rules that some guy who's supposed to be taking care of our security and has a guy who may have a fake resume in a key position and he doesn't have to answer a question about it? I think this news management and control is startling. Now, I have one other thing I want to throw
in.
What
is the fake resume? I hadn't heard that. What is it, actually, that he...
Well, he's about to claim to have been some sort of professor or something, and Time magazine broke this story. And I don't know whether it's true or not, but that's the point of a press conference. And the other item at this press conference was Brown was relieved of his responsibilities in New Orleans, but he's going to still stay on as head of FEMA. Well, the legitimate question was, is this the beginning of resignation, or how could he be giving up the most important part of his job, and yet we're going to trust him with the rest of the stuff and what's going on? And again, that questioner was cut off, and Chertoff didn't feel any need to respond. So, you know, it's one thing for the president of the United States, I guess he can get away with it at press conferences. He's not going to answer questions, not even have press conferences. But for this guy who's in a position where we have every right to ask these questions to be able to do that, I think he's the one, by the way, not Brown. I think Chertoff's the one that should resign. And I just want to throw in one other item. The media is sort of going along. I agree, they've been quite critical, but they're accepting the president's description of part of his blame game, that it's an act of nature, Mother Nature, the worst natural. Well, that is true of much of the impact of the storm. It's not true of New Orleans. New Orleans was not a direct hit. If the proper work had been done, and that includes the work done by this administration, withdrawing funds, diverting funds to Iraq and elsewhere, the proper work had been done, New Orleans would not have been subjected to this kind of tragedy. So it's insulting either to call it an act of God, it's blasphemous as far as I can see, or it's insulting to Mother Nature to blame her for the responsibility for this one. In fact, this is a man-made failure, particularly as applies to New Orleans.
All right.
Well, I agree, and that's why I'm so concerned that the Democrats have not really taken the opportunity to redefine what national security means. I mean, this is just a tragic opening given to them. And instead, they've pivoted to what they're comfortable with, which is the estate tax, fighting the estate tax. Now, I'm very glad they're fighting the estate tax, but that's not really the highest priority right now. When they can show very clearly how a military stretched by wars in Iraq and by the absence of the National Guard here at home were another very important factor in the Katrina tragedy, when they can show how the billions of dollars spent in Iraq are not being spent here at home, all those very obvious points that the public is ready to hear were not made. And as a result, we had this really interesting Zogby poll yesterday, which shows that any president since Carter would be beating Bush right now, but John Kerry would still be losing by one point.
You know, go ahead. I was going to mention one thing, though, Tony, which is that Bill Maher also had a funny column today, I think, Friday, in the L.A. Times, saying it's time for a recall of Bush. We need a real California-style recall at this moment. Go ahead.
Yeah, talking about the Democratic response, I think I mentioned last week that the danger for the Democrats is they misplay or overplay their response. And, of course, the classic maxim is don't interfere with someone committing suicide in politics. The Democrats, I think, have badly mismanaged their opposition, particularly on the black or race issue. The Gallup poll this week showed that 66% of blacks think that race had something to do with the poor performance of the administration, and 77% of whites did not think so. Thus, every time the Democrats, which they've been doing vociferously this week, accuse Bush of being either racist or insensitive or having race have some element in this, whether or not the substance of that charge is true, and I don't think it is, it is dangerously dysfunctional, because what it's doing is it's driving Bush supporters who have been a little upset with Bush's performance back into defending him because of the outrageous charge. And it also reduces the ability of the opposition party to make manifestly valid critiques of the administration's performance, because once people have heard that what they judge to be a ludicrous charge, then they're much less likely to listen carefully to others. This, by the way, is a lesson that I and Republicans and Newt and all the rest of us learned in the 90s in over-critiquing Bill Clinton.
That's a good point. Ariana, briefly.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying that this was the opportunity to redefine national security, to say basically that this guy who has had a double-digit lead over Democrats on the issue of who is going to keep us safer has not kept us safer. And that's an issue which can appeal to red states more than anything else. And that's the argument they have not been making.
Although I think there's still time for that, though. I want to get Bob, because we got a break in a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just say, I don't know whether it's politically wise to mention race, but race was very important in the whole treatment of New Orleans. There's no question about it. And I noticed Tony went back and forth. He said at first he doesn't know if it's true in substance, and then he said it's outrageous. But no. I don't think okay, I'm sorry. I don't know. But I don't think there's any question. I think there's a positive aspect also, by the way. I think the amount of aid that has gone in, the response of the country shows that we are not basically a racist people, that the American people don't want to abandon black people, and they don't think they're disposable. But I think the response of the administration, particularly in the first days, was atrocious. And I think had we had white people in some suburbs sitting on their roof saying, help us, that help would have arrived much more quickly. I don't have any doubt about it. But also the other aspect of race is these people were living in misery before the hurricane. And the fact that they couldn't get out, that they didn't have the credit cards, that they couldn't stay at hotels, that they didn't have the automobiles, that they were living in the worst kind of poverty, that they had dropped down through some through the safety net of American society is a comment on the racism society that precedes Bush. But certainly the Bush administration hasn't done anything to make it better.
Oh, no, but that's actually one of the most important points to emerge out of this, which is they were living in misery during the very prosperous Clinton 90s. They were not just living in misery during the Bush years. And that's really something which Democrats also need to address, because, you know, Democrats have not been mentioning poor people. When was the last time you heard a Democratic candidate talk about poor people as opposed to what are we going to do about the middle class? The middle class is code word for we're not going to deal with poverty.
Although John Edwards is, we're going to have to break and say, but John Edwards did, and even in statements this week, I mean, you do recall when he ran his whole campaign on the two Americas and on poverty, it didn't serve him, at least in trying to get to the top. But it's a theme I think he's going to keep pounding. Up ahead, Do we really rebuild New Orleans? Plus, Arnold's imminent gay marriage veto. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is in San Francisco on the left. Tony Blankley is in Washington on the right. Arianna Huffington here with me in Santa Monica and also somewhere beyond. We're continuing on Katrina. Let me ask, I know we've talked about the politics. When it comes to rebuilding, am I the only one who thinks we should at least ask the question? We're talking over $100 billion already that people are estimating the federal government's going to pour into this, an amount that is much more than went to New York after 9/11. Obviously, the damage and devastation is much broader here. But if New Orleans itself, the more you know, I was ignorant of this before this crisis, but the more you learn about the way it is sort of a it's just built in a bowl below sea level. Is it really right to go rebuild as it was the entire city of New Orleans? I'm not anti-New Orleans. I've loved times I've spent in New Orleans, but is it not? There was a guy on Charlie Rose the other night who is an expert on this, who's written a book on this, you know, kind of prophetically some years ago, saying if we shouldn't repair a broken window unless they take on a major whole regional reconstruction and swamp restoration, et cetera, that stops this from just being another total blowout waiting to happen. Anyone?
I think there's no doubt that we're going to rebuild New Orleans, and not just as some sort of a boutique Disney World kind of Bourbon Street ride, but as a real city with all its vigor. But it's also, I think, almost certain, although it's very early on, that they're going to take into account the environmental factors that New Orleans have and others have ignored for 250 years. And obviously, both the erosion element and some of the low-level residential areas are not going to be rebuilt in that location under the way they were built. Now, in the old days, a lot of New Orleans resident houses were built on stilts. That's hardly a complete answer or even a good one, but I think clearly the city will be completely rebuilt but reconfigured environmentally.
Bob?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, we're not going to rebuild Holland or anything. They seem to manage their water problem fairly effectively. And to argue that this somehow, again, this gets back to this natural disaster just waiting to happen, it's not true. Had they completed the work on the dikes, the two places where the dikes broke, and we know they didn't complete the work, we know the funds were diverted by this administration, we know the dikes wouldn't have broken, and everybody would have sighed in relief as they did during the first hours and said New Orleans was saved. Secondly, had they spent, and the figures vary, but somewhere between $2 and $10 billion that was needed to make a Category 5 system, there wouldn't have been any danger at all in this. So this is a manageable problem, not to mention, of course, holding back the rampant construction, the destruction of the wetlands, allowing the river to perform its normal function of dropping sediment outside and so forth. There are many enlightened things that could be done, but the symbolism of abandoning New Orleans, I think, is atrocious. I mean, for one thing, New Orleans had the hope, with all of its limitations, held out the hope of an integrated American city. It's one of the few places where at least there was the illusion, more than the reality sometimes, that there was race mixing. And there's a rich cultural heritage to New Orleans. It would be a criminal to abandon New Orleans. I think it's a very good use of our tax money, but I think the tax money should be spent in a way not to reward the people who have raped the land, but rather to build an ecosystem and a support system for New Orleans that's sustainable.
I think it's going to take a while before we can even address this question, because right now, you know, 60% of the city is still underwater. They're saying it will take years before the city can even provide drinkable water. So there are so many problems that we're still dealing. We're still in the middle of this crisis. So I think we should just other than playing the blame game, we should focus all our attention to solving the crisis.
Let's move on, because we've got a couple other areas to cover, and obviously we're going to be coming back to Katrina repeatedly. John Roberts this week, with the death, surprising to some, but to others it seemed likely to be close, of Chief Justice William Rehnquist. John Roberts got the nod from President Bush to change his appointment to that for Chief Justice. Just quickly around the horn, any thoughts on what this move means, what it means for the stakes for the other seat now that Bush has to come forward with an appointee for, Tony?
I think from a conservative point of view, the big issue now is to make sure that President Bush, given his current political problems, doesn't cave and appoint a sort of a moderate or type of appointment to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. There's going to be huge pressure, obviously, from the Democrats, and he may have some political advisors who will start saying, we don't need another fight. If he does that, if he doesn't nominate a solid, qualified conservative judge for the second seat, he will dramatically undercut the energy of support he's getting from his base, which is why he's not collapsed in the polls so far.
Bob?
You know, to hear Tony worry about a moderate being appointed reminds me of the great error made by the new left in this country, which is not to realize how important it was to have moderates and to attack some of the more moderate figures around who represented sanity, hoping that we'd get more. And I think the Republicans might come to regret the shaping of this court, but I think the rest of us will regret it even more, because I think the real danger here is not on the choice issue. I think the real danger is that Roberts represents a philosophy that says we don't need government. And we've been reminded in the last couple of weeks that we really need government. We need a progressive and aggressive government to control the marketplace. And this is where I think the rubber meets the road with the Republicans. They don't really care about a woman's right to choose. They care a lot about a corporation's right to greed and to profit. And that's the real issue here.
Ariana?
Look, this goes back to – I'm sorry, Ariana.
Ariana?
I was just watching Jon Stewart last night, and he had this kind of breaking news, Justine. John Roberts is a gentleman. And it's amazing how the coverage of Roberts in the press has been so driven by the fact that he has good grammar and he's clearly a gentleman. He's charming. And it shows again how sort of that version of class is informing so much of what the New York Times and other papers have been writing about him.
Yeah, just personally, it's amazing for him, though, to come out of it would have been something to get 2 years on a federal court and then get the nod for the Supreme Court, but suddenly to be likely to be running the court for the next, you know, if he's healthy, 25 or 30 years is kind of astounding. Tony, you had a thought there?
I was just going to respond to Robert. I mean, the point he makes that we need a big, vigorous government, this has been the great debate going back to the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists at the founding of the country, and nobody, neither side always wins that debate. And I think perhaps somebody clever said that floods are always liberal because they remind you of the need for big collective governmental action. And there's no doubt that the people who want the Federalist view, the big government view, are going to see this as an opportunity to remind people. And I think conservatives are going to be very well armed to respond to that. But the combination of that and the growing war on terror and the dangerous world we live in suggests to me that perhaps in the next 20, 30 years, the Federalists may win the better of the argument over the small government Jeffersonian anti-federalists.
Let's shift gears for a sec. Nationally relevant news out of California this week when Arnold Schwarzenegger, or at least his administration on his behalf, said that Governor Schwarzenegger would veto what is apparently the first bill passed by a legislature to make gay marriage legal, not by court action or others. Bob Scheer, I know you've been watching this closely. What does it mean? What are the stakes?
Well, first of all, it's a great advance for California because this is not under a court order. There's a state legislature saying and using the word marriage as opposed to civil union. So it's a great advance for civil rights as far as I'm concerned. And Schwarzenegger knows it is. He's lived in a community in which there are gay executives, there are gay couples all over the place, and they are good taxpayers, they follow the law, they can raise children effectively. So he knows that the basic argument for legalizing gay marriages is valid. And what he's done is fall back on a cheap, opportunistic trick. He's lacking in courage, and he says, well, you know, it's in the courts, or the voters spoke 4 or 5 years ago. First of all, if it's a civil rights issue, it doesn't matter really what the majority said, if the civil rights affecting a minority. And what the legislature in California has done is something very bold. They said this is a basic human right and we're going to affirm it. And the governor is being exposed as really not a moderate at all and not a reasonable person, but really a coward is the right word I would use. He's afraid to rise to challenge. It's a pity because it would have been his legacy had he signed this bill.
Tony?
Well, I mean, he is I don't know the exact vote percentage, but I believe a substantial majority of the public a few years back in California voted against this issue, and now a legislature presumably not reflecting, although perhaps the times have changed, but I rather doubt it, seeing all the polls last year on this issue, that the legislature passed something the majority is opposed to, and he is lining himself up with the majority over the alleged or theoretical rights of a minority.
So much for the conservative defense of representative government. Ariana?
Well, this is highly surprising. I mean, it's only surprising to those who thought that Schwarzenegger was going to be a moderate whom Democrats were going to love. And week after week, the environmentalists have been disappointed because he appointed an industry lobbyist to run a major department. People who thought he was going to be moderate on gay rights are being disappointed. You know, I'm sorry to say I'm not being disappointed. He's not doing anything that I didn't expect him to do.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tony Blankley, it's a lavishly luxurious rant. It's your soapbox.
I just want to make a clarification. I heard here in town today that someone said that Brown was being called a scapegoat. That's entirely wrong. A scapegoat is an innocent animal who is placed with the blame and sins of his people. It comes out of Leviticus, and it's out of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish holiday, and then the goat is driven out of town and over a cliff and killed. Two things are absent in this case. The goat has to be innocent. In this case, Brown is guilty. And the high priest who places the guilt of the people, or in this case, President Bush in his own responsibilities, has not announced his guilt and responsibilities. So on neither count is he a scapegoat. He's, in fact, simply a malfunctioning official.
Robert Scheer, and please feel free to include whatever sort of scriptural authority for your comment you can cite.
Well, there is some biblical authority for saying the poor should not be punished by this Christian administration. Let me just say the Census Department report that came out reminded us that poverty is not an isolated phenomenon there in New Orleans. There are 35 million people who get that label of being impoverished in the United States. That number increased by 1.1 million last year. It has gone up 17% in the last 5 years. Every single year of the Bush administration has seen a substantial increase in the number of poor people in this country, and it is a great national tragedy.
About 15 seconds, Ariana.
Well, for those who've been saying that this is not the time for finger-pointing, I'm saying this is precisely the time for finger-pointing. If we've learned anything from watching shows like CSI, you can't let a crime scene grow cold, and you've got to start collecting and analyzing the evidence while the DNA is still fresh and while the passions are high, and this is the time to do it.
The estate tax is an issue. The Republicans are still planning, I think, to bring this to a vote in the coming days to eliminate the estate tax. Nothing points up the craziness of trying to put hundreds of millions of dollars over the next 10 years back into the pockets of heirs whose lives would not be changed. This is the top 1% of wealth in America. At a time of grave national need, of national security needs, of New Orleans, of all these other unmet needs like the uninsured, hopefully this out of this national crisis will come the sense that it would be crazy to eliminate the estate tax as opposed to some more modest reforms. That's all the modesty we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to my co-hosts Bob Scheer, Ariana Huffington, and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is Ray Guarna. I'm Matt Miller. Tune in again next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.